going to sort of pretend that I'm like Scandal. All right. So, well, welcome to a session. We have about an hour together, and we want to talk about negotiation. And it is a topic that I personally have had a love-hate relationship with all my life. Now it's more love, but early on it was hate. I was one of those people who really tried not to create conflict wherever I was. I grew up in the South, and it was very clear that we needed to be nice, you know, and sort of cooperative and not make waves. And after a few years, I realized that wasn't working very well for me. So if you talk to my colleagues at Stanford, there are very few of them will agree with the following statement: Maggie avoids conflict. Because one of the things that I've learned is that in order to innovate, in order to create, in order to move the world, people are going to be unhappy. And so part of what I teach when I teach about negotiation is how to be as good at negotiating as you can, but it really means that you have to actually sometimes make people not as happy as they might be. And that's okay. But let me talk a little bit about negotiation per se as opposed to Maggie, because I want to talk about how to help you get more of what you want. And I want to do it with a particular filter. We're going to look at it through the filter of negotiating as a female, because there are some challenges that we face that our male colleagues do not face. But there are some surprising opportunities that we have, sort of like secret weapons, that our male colleagues don't have. So we're going to look at both sides of this. And I'm hoping to be able to give you some useful advice to walk away with so that you can get more of what it is you want in your negotiations. Now, for many of us, when we think about negotiations, there we go, we have this very negative perspective on what negotiations is. We see it as competitive and unpleasant. In fact, there was a study done where people asked, what do you think about negotiations? And it turns out that men and women have very different analogies they use for negotiations. For men, it's a competition. For women, it's akin to going to the dentist. Right? So it's sort of like, maybe that starts off. But what happens is the reason we find it so difficult is because we perceive negotiations as adversarial. And as soon as we think we're about to get into a negotiation, we may figuratively put on that battle armor, being ready to do battle with our counterpart to try to get things from them that they don't want to give us and try to keep them from getting things from us that we don't want them to have. And one of the problems with that mindset is that if you believe that negotiations are battles, they all become battles. Now, I will grant you that there are some negotiations that are battle-like. But for the most part, most of the negotiations that we engage in are not battles. So what I want you to do first is, I want you to think and rethink your definition of negotiation. Broaden it to include two or more people, decide what each is willing to give and hopes to get in their interaction, and through a process of mutual influence, and this is really critical because there's no command and control in negotiation. I can't force you to say yes. All I can do is present proposals that, from your perspective, make it in your interest to agree. So we move with a common course of action. We agree on a common course of action. Now, what that means is that negotiation, at least in the world that I inhabit, and maybe I'd like to invite you to join me in that, is what we do mostly in social situations. We are always in situations where we are trying to influence people, and the more we are a leader in an organization, the more we are doing that. And so what I want you to think about is negotiation as one of the critical leadership skills for women and for men in today's organizations. Because even if sometimes hierarchically you may have command and control, official power, most of us have already seen how that works, right? Command and control, no. Usually you have to kind of engage your subordinates, your peers, and your superiors to move in a direction, which means that what you really want to do is you want to reframe your negotiations move away from this adversarial, battle-like mentality to a perspective of collaborative problem solving. Now, let me be really clear here. What I'm not suggesting is that you are just looking for a yes. No. You are looking for a solution that makes you better off than you would have been given your alternatives or the status quo. And because, again, negotiation is a process where your counterpart must willingly join you in the path, in the agreement, where that person has to at least feel they are not worse off and they may feel better off. That's the solution space you're looking for. What that also means is if you move to this collaborative problem-solving perspective, one of the really interesting things is it opens up huge opportunities to negotiate. It moves us out of the landscape of these big, honking, painful, scary negotiations to the land of everyday interactions. And it's that transition that I think provides us with a huge opportunity to claim value in the interaction. Let me give you a simple example, a little example, of what I mean when I talk about expand what is negotiable. A couple of years ago, I was sitting in my office working on a research paper, and I wasn't getting very far. And when I get bored or I get stuck, everything in my office becomes more interesting than the paper I'm working on, right? So I went to my usual place to spend inordinate amount of time, to my email, to sort of see what had happened since I last looked at it. And I noticed there was an email from my dean. My dean writes a lot of emails. And so some of them are of the style where you look at them and you know immediately we can just delete this and I don't have to even read it, right? So it's like, welcome so-and-so to the Graduate School of Business, blah, blah, delete. Right? But this one, you know, because I have those three lines in my email where I can see it immediately, and I saw the word provost in those first three lines. For those of you not familiar with academic administration, the provost is the senior academic officer of the university. He's my boss, the dean's boss. Okay? And so, in summary, the email said the provost at Stanford had realized that the amount of teaching credit that business school faculty got for every hour of contact time with their students was different than the amount of teaching time that the law school faculty members got for an hour of teaching time for their students, which was different than the engineering school, which was again different from the medical school. And he said, this is crazy. We have four professional schools. We're going to rationalize this. The email goes on. At the end of the email, it says, so, based upon the provost's new algorithm, you will be going from 5 classes a year to 6 classes a year. Best wishes, the dean. Now, that was not, I like to teach. But I think 5 is enough. And I am inherently lazy, so let's just stop at 5. Well, so now if I'd done nothing, if I just accepted what my dean had said, I was now going to have to teach a new course. Which means I was going to have to prep a new course, and that where that time was going to come from was sort of like sleeping, eating, okay, watching Scandal sometimes, okay. But those sorts of time, you know, my disposable time that was my free time. I didn't like that very much. So I read the email very carefully, and there were two things that popped into my head. Number one is something that the dean and I both knew, and that is that the dean and the provost didn't collude as a way to get Maggie Neal to teach more classes. It's like, hey, let's change all this so Maggie will teach 6 rather than 5. The dean had already negotiated with me and my colleagues that 5 was an appropriate load. He was fine with that. The only reason I was moving to 6 was for him to accommodate the demands of his superior. Okay? That's number one. Number two, here's what I knew, but probably my dean didn't know, is that he knows I teach experiential courses. I teach negotiation. I teach teams. And it's really hard to end a course that's experientially based exactly on time. So my classes were running from 3:30 to 6:30 in the evening, and they would often go to 6:45 to 7 o'clock. And at 6:30 on the dot, and you all know this because you probably all did it to your faculty, as soon as that second hand hits the 12 at 6:30, people start shutting their books, looking at their watches, looking back at the clock, and looking at me expectantly like, we are done. And I'd go, no, we're not done. We have some more stuff. Because what would happen is, you know, I had the course worked out, and at 6:15, I was really on the way to be able to end at 6:30. But no, somebody asked a question, which completely hijacked the class. We had to deal with it. And by now, it's 6:45, 7 o'clock. So I would get punished in my teacher ratings because I wasn't ending on time. They would say, we wish Professor Neal would learn how to tell time. So I said to the dean, I made an appointment with the dean, and I said to him, I have a favor to ask. And he said, what's that? I said, I'd like to extend my courses from 3 hours to 3.5 hours, since it was already what I was doing most of the time. And he said, why? And I said, well, and I told him why. I gave him the little explanation about experiential classes, hard to finish, but I could do it in 3.5 hours. And the dean said, fine, because it was a solution to a problem that he had. Not the provost, but what makes deans happy? Happy students. Because what do happy students become? Happy alumni who become happy donors. You're absolutely right. So he said, sure, your courses from now on will be 3.5 hours per session long. I said, great, I really appreciate that. That's going to make it better for my students because I think they actually like the fact that we will respond to these unique questions they ask. But they have lives, too, and they'd like to have some control over when they, you know, get out of class. He said, great. And as I was getting ready to leave, I said, oh, and by the way, given that I'm teaching 3.5 hours per class meeting, that means I'm teaching 5 classes rather than 6, right? And he said, yes, of course. I said, thank you. Have a nice evening. I'm done. Because we negotiated. Now, I suspect that he didn't even see it as a negotiation. I was asking for a solution to a problem that my students and I had. The solution helped him, and all of a sudden now, I'm better off. And this is what I mean about negotiations. They take place, they can take place all the time. But you need to think about what it is you're trying to achieve when you engage in this problem-solving collaboration with your colleagues that is negotiation. And the first thing is what we often think about is creating value. How do we make the pie larger, right? And that's actually a very important goal. That's what we call that is synergy. How do your perspectives and my perspectives come together that make us both better off? But when you're negotiating, I'm going to say something a little bit heretical here from many of my negotiating colleagues. Your goal in negotiation is not to create value. You create value in the service of claiming value. Because what you want to look at the end of the day is, what do you walk away with? Are you better off after the negotiation than you would have been had you not negotiated? And it might seem reasonable that the more value you create, the easier it is to claim. But one of the things that's really a surprise to some people is that the more value you create, you begin to make it impossible for you to claim. And so you really have to walk that very fine line between value creation and value claiming. Some people, by the way, aren't interested at all in either value creation or value claiming. All they care about is winning. And you've all been in negotiations where the other side really needed to win. What's really interesting about that is those people are actually kind of fun to negotiate with. Because you can behave in ways that make them think that they have won, when in fact you have claimed more of the value. Because in effect what they're saying is, I will give you value if you will give me the perception that I am able to walk away the winner. And you know what? That's not that hard to do. You all know how to do that because you've been doing it all your lives. Okay, that's number one. But number two, here's the other problem. A lot of us walk into a negotiation and the only thing we judge the success of that negotiation by is, did we get a deal? And so we privilege getting an agreement over the quality of that agreement. Sometimes we take deals that make us worse off than had we never negotiated at all. Now, one of the challenges is that there is a real attraction that we human beings have to the notion of agreement in negotiation. And in fact, one of my colleagues has talked about this as the bias to agreement, the belief that agreement equals success in a negotiation. And I want to, this is a study that was done, we're not going to spend much time on it, but I want you to look at the relative positions of the blue line and the red line. In a series of studies, participants were asked to choose between option A and option B. And if you look at the blue line, that's what we're going to talk about first, that's the number of participants who actually chose option A. It was not a real positive option for the individual, but not so bad that nobody chose it, but you have a range from a low of 4% to about a high of 33% of people who chose option A. In the red line, all the experimenters did was change, was pull out the word option A or the label option A and throw in the word agreement. And look how much more attractive option A became when we characterized it as an agreement alternative. So this is one of the things I want you to be really aware of, is that we sometimes privilege getting a yes. We sometimes privilege getting to yes over getting a good deal. And that's not the goal of a negotiation. The goal of a negotiation is not to get a deal. The goal of a negotiation is to get a good deal, which means you have to understand what a good deal is for you and when it is in your interest to walk away. Now, let's think about what we know about what is a good deal. How do you know what a good deal is? The first thing is you need to know what your alternatives are. What happens to me if there were no agreement? What's my status quo? In my discussions with my dean, I would be teaching 6 classes. I knew what that was, right? Or I could say to my dean, are you kidding me? 6 classes? I won't stand for that. I'm going to find another job. Well, I'd just be crazy. Actually, there is no better job than being at Stanford at the business school, so, you know. And he knows that, too. Anyway, so if he said 6, I'd go, well, just wanted to make sure, you know, wanted to ask. No harm in asking. Now, it turns out that the better my alternatives, the more power I have in the negotiation. And again, this shouldn't come as a surprise to any of you. Because think about dating. If you have lots of people who want to go out with you, you can be very demanding about what you do and where you go and how much it will cost, right? But if you have been in a desert and there's been no one around, nobody's knocking on your door, you're not going to be very demanding because your alternatives are not very strong. And so this is exactly what this is. The better your alternatives, the more value you will claim in the negotiation, because in order for you to reach a deal, your counterpart has to pay you to stay in play. So when you have lots of alternatives, and those alternatives are going to set the bar for what is your minimally acceptable deal, and the better your alternatives, the more demanding you will be in the negotiation. Now, your alternatives are outside the negotiation. So what happens is they inform what happens in the negotiation. And so the other issue you need to think about is, what's my bottom line? What's that point where I'm indifferent between saying yes and saying no? Before you walk into a negotiation, you need to know what your alternatives are. You need to know what your bottom line is. However, if that is all you think about in a negotiation, you will systematically underperform. And you will underperform because of a very powerful psychological phenomenon, which we can describe in 3 words. Expectations drive behaviors. So if I think about my alternative, which is what happens to me if there's no deal, and my reservation price, which is the worst possible outcome I could say yes to, if that's all that's in my head, that's where I will end up, because I'm setting my expectations based upon those. What I also need is that third point, and that is a critical piece of information that most folks in negotiation don't have the discipline to think about, and that is your aspiration. What is an optimistic assessment of what you could achieve in this negotiation? You need to basically raise your expectations about what is possible, because expectations drive behavior. You may not reach your aspiration, but having an aspiration will raise up your average performance in a negotiation. Now, why is it you need to negotiate? Well, it turns out there's some real challenges that we women face. I want to tell you about a little piece of research that was done by a colleague of mine, Mara Bellevue. And what she did was she asked 184 managers that were told they had a set amount of money to allocate between and among their equally responsible and productive employees. There were two conditions. They were both male and female employees. Two conditions. The first condition was, once you allocate the salary, your subordinates will have no opportunity to talk to you about why you did what you did. And in that condition, the managers, both male and female managers, gave their men and the women equal raises, which you would expect because they were equally responsible and productive, right? Fine. In the second condition, they were told, well, you know what? Your subordinates do have the opportunity to come back and talk to you about why you gave the raise you gave to them. And when they did that, the managers, both males and females, gave the men 2.5 times more money than the women. Why do you think they did that? The women aren't going to complain. The men are going to complain, but not every man will not complain every time, so we're going to raise the salary of the men to keep them out of the manager's office. There'll be some who still do, but the women, we already know they won't. So this research stands in stark contrast. Some of you may have remember in October of 2014, there was a big brouhaha. You remember the Microsoft CEO, Nadella, who said, secret power for women, karma, never negotiate. This research here makes me very nervous about that particular strategy, right? It's good karma. Everything will come to those who wait. No. This says, you wait, you long time. Long time. All right. Why women don't negotiate? There are a lot of reasons. The first one is, we don't even think it's an option. There were actually, in that memo that the provost and the dean sent to the faculty, there were 35 other faculty members' names on that memo. I'm the only one who went to the dean and got 5 classes back. Why? Well, for most of my colleagues, it's not that they are shy, but they didn't even see it as an opportunity. Provost to dean to me seems like a done deal. And I said, well, let's talk. Oftentimes what happens is we don't even consider negotiation because we believe it's not done here. Some of you may have heard this before, but it's my favorite story. How many of you have ever been to a department store called Nordstrom's? Bought anything? Negotiated the price? I expect that there are a few of you out there, some of you raising your hands, and I say congratulations. What I want to know is, why didn't the rest of you? What stops you from negotiating at Nordstrom's? Well, I have a couple of hypotheses. One is you're like, I never even thought about it. You mean you can negotiate? Well, yeah. Because what happens when you don't think it's even possible? It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? So you don't. And then, see, it doesn't. Some of you might not negotiate at Nordstrom's because you think, if I negotiate at Nordstrom's, people will think I am poor, right? Turns out we've actually done that research. If you actually look at the correlation between socioeconomic status and the willingness to negotiate, it is, in fact, a positive relationship. The higher your social economic status, the more likely you are to negotiate. Those of us who are a little concerned about our socioeconomic status, like, oh no, if I negotiate, they think I'm poor. No, actually, they probably don't. Because rich people are the ones who go, no, I could pay for that, but I don't choose to. Let's talk, right? You know, or some of you are thinking, well, that clerk doesn't even have the authority. So you never ask. So here's some homework. It's really easy homework. Go to Nordstrom's. Find something that's a little expensive, but you want it. And go and see if you can negotiate the price. If you are really, really serious, there's a much harder task. Go to Neiman Marcus. Because they're like, if you need to negotiate, maybe you should go to Macy's, right? You know, so. But try it. Because this is a very safe environment to negotiate, right? Because what if they say no? You go, okay. It's too expensive anyway. Or if they say yes, and you can, and even if you don't want to buy it, you can say, well, you know what, I changed my mind. Thanks, though. Right? We oftentimes, though, don't negotiate in situations where we know other people negotiate. Where we know people negotiate for their compensation. Where they know that people negotiate for how many courses they're going to teach. And we don't do it. And the reason we don't do it is because we are concerned, two concerns, especially for women, the perceived adversarial nature of negotiation. We're going to make an enemy. Our number two, that people will think we are greedy, demanding, and not nice. And how many of you have censored yourself from negotiating because you were afraid people will think that you're greedy, demanding, and not nice? We have a short-term word for that, but, you know, yeah. A few of you are raising your hands like, they won't like me if I negotiate. They probably won't like you if you don't either, so it's like... All right, let's talk about it. Well, you know, it's not just us in our lives. Think about the women in the U.S. Open. In 2006, they had a grand, in the U.S. Open Grand Slam tournament, they had a new technological innovation. They had instant replay. And so there were a limited number of calls that the players could object to per player, a limit per player. The player could object to, that they would then take the instant replay and look and see what happened. Turns out that about a third of the time, when the players objected, the instant replay showed that the players were right. What's really interesting is to look at the difference by gender of how many complaints there were. It turns out that the men challenged 73 calls. And this was controlling for the number of games, right? The men challenged 73 calls. The women challenged just slightly above one-third of that. They both got one-third of them supported, but the women were much less likely. Now, perhaps you could make a rationale for why that's the difference is. Maybe the women's game is much slower than the men, so the judges are less likely to make errors. Possibly. Maybe the women, the judges are actually watching the women's games more closely. Maybe. Or maybe the women don't ask. Even women who are at the top of their professional field. And if you think, I love that little thing at the bottom, if you don't think it's 2006, that was like ancient history. In 2013, they checked again, same effect. The women were significantly less likely to ask than their male counterparts. So, a colleague of mine, Linda Babcock, years ago, some of you may have heard of her. She wrote a wonderful book called Women Don't Ask, and this is the reason she wrote the book, this particular finding. And that is, she found that the starting salaries of men were 7.6% less than the starting salaries of women who were graduating from the Carnegie Mellon MBA program. And what she found was that she found that result, which is not unusual. But what she also did, she asked a couple of questions. She asked a couple of questions of her MBA students. And she said, well, when you got the offer, did you attempt to negotiate the terms of your employment contract? And she found a very big difference. 7% of the women, 57% of the men attempted to negotiate the terms of their employment contracts. She also said, well, how successful were you? And she found no difference by gender in their success. if you negotiated, you got on average about a 7% increase. Now, the question is, if I show this to my students, and they're quick to report, you know, because they can do math in their heads, and they go, okay, let's say it's a $100,000 salary. You're telling me that I should risk my reputation, right? I could be greedy, demanding, and not nice for $7,000. Doesn't that seem stupid, crazy? And when they say that to me, I am so disappointed. But it's probably not for the reason you think, because I actually think that if you don't want to negotiate, that's fine, but you should understand what the costs and benefits are. And sometimes when we're afraid of being perceived as too greedy, demanding, and not nice, those costs loom large compared to these benefits. But let's try to do the benefits a little more objectively. So here's what I want to do. It's a little thought experiment. For those of you who have not seen this example, I'd like you to participate here. The rest of you who already know the answer, suppose at age 30, two equally qualified applicants, Chris and Frazier, get job offers for $100,000 a year from the same company. Chris negotiates and gets a 7.6% increase. So Chris starts at 107.6. Frazier accepts the $100,000. Okay? Now, we're going to make two heroic assumptions. The company treats these two people identically. For the next 35 years, that's the other heroic assumption, they stay at the same organization so we can watch. The next 35 years, they get the same 5% raise. And the question I want to ask you is, when Chris retires at 65, how many more years will Frazier have to work to make up the difference? So just open outcry. What do you think? Oh, you guys are good. It's actually 8. So it's not $7,600. It's 8 years of your life. Now are you thinking about maybe negotiating? And by the way, it gets worse. It just gets worse, right? Because when Frazier and Chris start out, they are about the same. But what happens over those 35 years? By the time Chris retires, Chris is making $100,000 a year more than Frazier. How does the company, how do their bosses interpret that difference? Do they say, oh, right, remember 35 years ago, Frazier didn't negotiate, but Chris did, that's why? What do they say? Chris is more valuable to the company. So Chris isn't going to get the same raises. What's going to happen is Chris is going to get more. But what happens if we just give Chris slightly more of those 35 years? 5.5%. Frazier gets 5. Now how many more years? Well, it's more than 8. And let's make it 6%. From the start, from the get-go, Chris gets 6%. Frazier gets 5%. Frazier can't live long enough. So there are differences. There are absolutely differences in compensation. But one of the things that we have more impact on is the ability to say, you know what? Let me ask. Get the data. Let me ask. So if you don't want to negotiate, that's fine. I hope you like that job because you're going to be working there for a lot longer and you will never catch up. Expectations drive behavior. It turns out that one of the few systematic differences that researchers can find between men and women in as they contemplate a negotiation is that women have lower expectations than men do about what they're worth. So they're willing to accept less. And so it turns out that how expectations drive our behavior, we have from the 1960s in the early work of Robert Rosenthal and the Pygmalion effect, where he got sixth grade teachers and he told them, we'd done all this testing of your students, which was a complete lie, he'd done nothing. And what he said was, we've identified a subset of your students who will blossom intellectually. What he'd really done is randomly assigned students to the blossom intellectual condition. And then he left. He told the teachers who they were and left. At the end of the year, he got the standardized achievement test scores. And what he found was exactly what he had predicted. Those students who he had said would blossom intellectually, in fact, did significantly better on their achievement test scores at the end of the year than those who were not in that group. And he had randomly assigned them to that group. Turns out, if you fast forward to the 1990s, we have a new version of that called stereotype threat, which is the concern a person feels when they're about to confirm as positive a negative stereotype about their group. It creates anxiety. It turns out that we have a great example in women especially if you're an Asian woman, you've got a wonderful, you have this like amazing conflict. Because think about your math performance, right? If you focus on your Asian stereotype, there is a stereotype about Asians being good in math. Or if you focus on your female stereotypes, you are bad in math. So what they did is they got a group of Asian women, and they divided them into two groups. And they highlighted, they made them focus on their female identity or their ethnic identity. And they gave them a math test. And those who focused on their ethnic identity did significantly better than those who focused on their female identity. And this new study just came out, I think it was in 2013. It said, when a woman takes a test under somebody else's name, we don't see this difference. So it's actually, I don't mind if, you know, it's just I'm not reifying that stereotype. So from now on, my name is Roslyn when I take math tests because I want to make sure I don't get fall prey to this. This is called stereotype threat. We can see it in negotiation. We have expectations about how men and women negotiate. By the way, there is no empirical evidence that these are true, but we have these strong expectations, but then expectations drive behavior. So then these expectations become real. So what these researchers did is they said they put men and women into two groups. So they had negotiating, two-party negotiation. They had a male and a female. Male negotiating in opposition to a female. So it was always what we call mixed gender pairs. Half of the mixed gender pairs were told the following information. They didn't see those blue labels. They just got the information. They said, negotiators who display the following behaviors tend to perform worse. They have a high regard for their personal interest. They depend on assertive behaviors. They rely on rational analysis, and they don't show their emotions. Those people do worse. The other half, both males and females, got the other information. Negotiators who display the following behavior tend to perform worse. They are passive or reactive in expressing their interest. They rely on their own listening skills, on intuition, and they display emotion. Those people do worse. Then the experimenter said, okay, people, two groups, right? What happens? What are you expecting? How well do you think you will do in this negotiation? What is your aspiration? And what you should notice is that in the far left side, right, those who got the negative male information, the females in the blue bar had higher aspirations for their performance than their male counterparts did. And in the right-hand set, you see those who got the negative female information, the males had higher aspirations than their female counterparts. But that's just aspirations. We haven't negotiated. Let's look at the negotiation results. And what you see is an amazing interaction. Look at that. In the far left hand, now they got the negative female information. What you see is when folks got the negative female information, the males outperformed their female counterparts. But when the folks, both males and females, got the negative female information, they got the negative male information, the females outperformed. And there's no difference between the high-performing males and the high-performing females in terms of how well they did. It's our expectations that drive our behaviors. So why do we settle for less? We don't have to settle for less, but we do. And the first is that there is significant psychological pressure for us to get to an agreement. And we are very concerned with being perceived as greedy or demanding. So we come to agreement too quickly. Secondly, there is an escalation of commitment. That is, we don't walk away. Because once we start a negotiation, if you think the only way to be successful is you get a yes, means you got to stay there until you do. And if I know you won't walk away, I can press you down until I get all of the value in the negotiation. Your biggest source of power in a negotiation is your ability to either, one, convince the other side that you will walk away, or actually to walk away. And oftentimes what happens is we get so caught up, we get so focused on getting an agreement that we ignore the options that we might have if no agreement were reached. So why women don't ask? Well, here's another reason. We're still in the bad news part of this, okay? Here's another reason. When negotiating a single issue, compensation, it turns out that women were less inclined to negotiate than men, and there was a good reason for that, because evaluators penalized female candidates more than male candidates for initiating that negotiation. They were more likely to say they're greedy, demanding, and not nice. Now, turns out that female evaluators penalized female candidates but did not penalize male candidates. And if you're thinking maybe it would be better if I had a woman I was negotiating with, no. But at least she's equal opportunity. She penalized both males and females for negotiating, right? And so part of the reason is that we face harsher penalties for attempting to negotiate in a very adversarial way. Because when you talk about a single issue, which is about money, it typically is more adversarial. So what are you to do? Okay, Now we're going to start going back up, all right? Because that's kind of like, that's the bottom. So let's go back up. You need to ask differently. Women were more influential in their negotiations when they paired their competence with a communal concern for the other. Let me restate this. A problem-solving orientation. The solution, or one of the big solutions, one of the big parts of the answer to how can I be more effective in my negotiation is to focus my negotiations not as adversarial interactions, but as collaborative problem-solving endeavors, and you know how to do that. Think about what I can win. So the communal concern is, how can I help you? Your counterpart will tell you what the problem is that they face. It's not hard for them, it's not hard to get that information from them. And then you craft a solution that makes you better off and helps them solve their problem. So one of the things that becomes very critical for you to understand is how important it is to have that problem-solving orientation, because how can you think somebody is greedy, demanding, or not nice when they are helping you solve your problems? So if you reframe negotiations as problem-solving, I've got a four-step process I want you to think about. First, assess the situation. What's that situation? Is there an opportunity for me to negotiate? And that is, can I improve my status quo? Can I improve where I am or my alternatives? If that's true, then do I have information that my counterpart may not have that can open up new vistas of solutions? And we oftentimes find ourselves in situations where we do have unique information that our subordinates, our peers, our superiors do not have. And bringing that information to the table is one of the ways that we can begin that collaborative problem solving. Now, then I have to prepare. What are the real issues in dispute? What are my alternatives? What's my reservation price? What are my aspirations? Why am I negotiating? And then let me think about my counterpart, because remember, I have to get them to be willing to say yes. So I've got to be able to frame my proposals in a way that seems like a solution to their problems. Then I have to initiate the conversation. I have to make the ask. You see, what I'm really getting you to do when you go to Nordstrom's is just ask. And that's what we don't do. We don't ask. And then you want to be able to have solutions, creative solutions that you've thought about in advance that you can bring to the table. And this is another thing that we oftentimes overlook, but I want you to think about negotiating at the level of the package. Most of us have been taught, or we sort of absorbed the belief that we should negotiate issue by issue. If you negotiate issue by issue, you create a series of battles. Somebody's going to win, somebody's going to lose, we go to the next one, somebody's going to win, somebody's going to lose. What you want to be able to do is negotiate at a package. You want to have multiple issues that you have so that you can craft a solution where, yes, we can adjust things, but there's not you win this one and I win that one. One of the things that's really critical is to keep the negotiation at the package level. Most folks will try to get you to negotiate issue by issue because they believe another erroneous myth of negotiation, which is solve the easy issues first. What a bad strategy. Solve the easy issues first sounds reasonable because we get some solutions to some of the issues. It makes us harder for us to walk away. Therefore, we can maximize our goal of getting an agreement. But solve the easy issues first. What happens there is it actually makes a couple of really dumb assumptions. Number one, it assumes that my easy issues are your easy issues. What if they're not? What if what's really easy for me is really important for you? We solve that, and I lose a degree of freedom that I could have had in the package to craft, I'll give you more of what you care about, which is not that important to me, in order to get something I care more about. So what you need to do is you need to frame your negotiations in a package, but also yoking things together so that if I give you a concession here, I get a concession here. And this packaging helps you keep the negotiation at this problem-solving level rather than it deteriorating to a battle. So, to get more of what you want, what do you need to do? The first thing I want you to do is to remember that negotiation is an interdependent process. You have never gotten a bad deal that you didn't agree to. So, be aware that of your responsibility in taking those bad deals. Now, what happens, of course, is if you're prepared to walk away while leaving open the possibility, it turns out that they may have some problems too. Number one, they may actually have a really bad alternative. They would really like you to come and to their organization. They would like you to help solve the problem with the solution, but they're hoping that you'll give them more. Secondly, they may also agree that agreement equals success, because a lot of folks do that, so you could use that. I'd love to be able to reach a deal with you, but this proposal simply won't work. And if that's your best offer, I'm going to have to walk away. No, not hard feelings. I'm not upset about it. I'm disappointed. But I hope that we could come to a reasonable accommodation. But this isn't it. The power of the ask. And this is one of the things I ask not just my female colleagues and my female students, but my male colleagues and my male students. If you don't ask, how will others know what you want? And this is the whole thing about problem solving, right? You want to find a solution that makes you better off and keeps them at least whole. But you have to ask. And here is the secret power. While women typically get less for themselves in negotiation, if we kind of distilled all of the research and all of the findings that we have, you're better off negotiating on average if you're a male. You'll get more for yourself. But what's absolutely stunning is that you actually will get, if you are negotiating for me and you're a woman, you will come away with 14 to 22% more than if you're negotiating for me and you're a man. Women outperform men in representational negotiations between 14 and 22%. And all of you know this because you have no problem. But those of you who don't like to negotiate, find it really hard to negotiate for yourself, you have no problem negotiating for others. You are like a lion in there. And then you are like a pussycat when it comes to yourself. Oh no, I don't want to make you unhappy. But if it's your team you're negotiating for, there's no social pushback, right? Because you're not greedy or demanding. You're doing it for your people. So now, here's what I want to ask you. For whom do you negotiate? Team? Your organization? How about for all those women who come after you, so that when 184 managers have to allocate raises and they know people might come back to negotiate, they are not going to give the women less because they know women won't ask. So if you need somebody to negotiate for, think about your daughters, your nieces, your granddaughters, and even if you have no get anywhere, all those people who come after you. How much are you willing to pay? This is a question for yourself. How much are you willing to pay to potentially be perceived as nice and avoiding making people uncomfortable? Too many of us are willing to pay too much for this fantasy. So I have a solution, a very easy solution for this. If what you are really concerned about is you really want to be loved, there is a simple solution. Get a dog. I have been married for 34 years to the same guy, okay? And I come home after, a week gone, and he's like, hey, good to see you, right? My dogs are like, oh my God, I never thought you'd come back. My life was terrible without you. You are the sun, the moon, the stars, my husband has never said those things to me. I can be gone for an hour, my dogs say that to me. Okay, that is love. If you need to be loved, go rescue a dog, right? You need to be strategic. You need to ask, but you need to be strategic in how you ask. So, a couple of things. If you want to know more, I've got three books I'm recommending these days. Linda Babcock, Sarah Lashevere's book. You got two versions of it. The first one, the 2003 book, is the research version. And the 2009 version is the more practitioner version. So it's a little less about how many subjects and the kind of analysis that was done. If you've not read Robert Cialdini's book, any book by Robert Cialdini, you have got to go out and buy it. Influence. He actually started writing that book in 1994. He revised it through 2009. It will tell you how people are influencing you in ways you can't even imagine and haven't realized. And then in July of 2015, I have a new book coming out called Getting More of What You Want by Basic Books. And if you haven't heard enough from me, here are a few places you can hear more Most of these are YouTube available, so you can sort of look at that and see. And with that, what I'd like to do is we have about how much longer do we have? 7 minutes. If we have anybody who has a question, I'm willing to take it. Go right to the microphone. Go, if you have questions, go to the microphones. I have given them to the powers that be, and said, so they should be available. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so I'm going back to work after being at home for 5 years, and yes. I had been in the insurance business for like 12 years. Mm-hmm. How can I negotiate like the salary, kind of like the same that
okay.
I was making before?
I just told you don't just negotiate salary. That's issue by issue. The package. So it's like all sorts of things. What resources do I need to do my job? What kind of benefit can I create for you? What did my 5 years at home, what kind of skills did that develop for me? But you want to create a package. Once you start negotiating salary, it's going to become a fight. Go to the package, craft a solution. And by the way, think about your counterparts. What can they give you that's easy for them to give you that's good and important for you? Yes.
How do you create leverage if you have no leverage and you want to negotiate?
Well, when you say, so you have no alternatives? Really? I mean, like, is there just an abyss in front of you and that's it?
If you've worked hard, you want to keep your job, but.
So if you're currently in a position and you're now thinking, you know what, I think I need to go check and see whether I'm being treated reasonably or not, and you find out you're not. So there's some homework there. Because you don't want to just go in and say, you know what, I want more. And they say, why? I said, because more is better than less. That's not going to do it. So the question is, do you have a reason or a rationale for why you want more? Are you being paid less than people who are in similar positions for you? So you need the data. And let me just tell you that how much easier it is now that you have the data, that you have the internet to find that data. Because it used to be, you'd have to have a bunch of friends. But by the way, that's not a bad solution. What about the people who are in your social network? Use them to get the information and then leverage the information. Because most people don't want to say, well, you know, I'm paying you less because you're female, that's why. Right? They're not going to say that. But they may be paying you less because you're female because of some non-conscious bias. Raise the issue.
Hi, Margaret. Thank you. I used your video on the Lean In website, actually, to help me prepare for my offer negotiation, which I just got out of. It took about a month. And I experienced all these things that you just talked about. This was the first time that I had dared in my career to negotiate an offer. I felt that, you know, that pushback, I got the feedback about the penalty that mm-hmm. I had negotiated and they didn't perceive me as nicely. But I do feel that positions me better for the future when they are handing out raises, that they know they're going to have a fight with me. So they better allocate more for me than just the bare minimum. Mm-hmm. In the process of negotiation, I focused on my seniority level more than the salary mm-hmm. because I wanted to close that leadership gap, not just on my behalf, but on behalf of women. Mm-hmm. And so that really helped me. But before they gave on that leadership level, they threw a signing bonus at me to try mm-hmm. to get me to accept the lower level. Mm-hmm. And I held firm, and they ended up giving me the more senior title, but they took away the salary bonus. And I would have been fine without it if I hadn't been offered it in the first place, but now I feel like I've lost something, mm-hmm. and I feel like both of us feel like we've had a lose-lose mm-hmm. outcome mm-hmm. from this. So I'm wondering, like, are there things after the agreement that we can do, that I can do to, you know, help us come back to seeing value?
So I want to answer a slightly different question than you asked. I want to say, what happens when they took it away at the moment, when they say, you could say, you know what, why don't we do this? Let's create a contract where if I perform at a certain level, I get this, right? Because just think, let's say that you go up and they say, and you're in the organization, and they say no. Mm-hmm. And you don't get a raise. And you say, okay. And they give you a reason, because they're always going to give you a reason. And you say, okay, tell me what are where's the gap between where I am now and what I have to, because you see, it's not just one negotiation, it's ongoing. And so I'm going to say to you, I really care about my performance and I want to do well in this organization, so tell me what my gaps are. So that when I fill those, now I can come back to you, right? Because now you've begun a negotiation for the next time.
Got it.
And so part of it is you don't want to end with the just, well, okay, I'll take this. Because the point is, and I really appreciate the fact that you did this, and maybe we can sort of look at how that bonus might be affected by my performance. And I'm willing to I'm willing to bet that my performance is better than you think it is.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay? Yeah.
I had a question. You spoke to the bias to agreement. Is that cultural, or is that not uniformly distributed?
Well, this research was done primarily on Western European, but I would suspect that even that among Western European folks, you're more likely to have a, you're less likely to have a bias to agreement than you are in cultures that are more collectivistic or clan-like. So again, cross-cultural research will give us some differences, but I think this is a conservative test of that, not a generous one, okay? Yes, last question. Well, there's somebody in the back of the room. Wait, before I go to you, let me go to her back there. You, yes.
Okay, thanks. So in business school, they talk about anchoring technique, and you talked about, you know, your aspiration level versus your reservation point. So when you're bringing that package to the table, is it smart to really ask for, like, a lot more than what you're hoping for, especially in the areas that are more important to you in that package versus not? So tell me about, like, you know, when you put that proposal out, you know, kind of how sort of above or at the aspiration level you should ask for.
I think that one of the issues that you face, if you are an average woman, you underestimate your worth.
So this isn't for me. This, you know, I do negotiate.
No, I understand. What I'm saying is my aspirations are high.
Right.
Because I'm not going to get them typically. But they will raise up what I do get.
But I feel like there's a balance in terms of credibility, you know, in terms of, like, you know, I feel like if you're authentic and credible, you're going to get more sometimes. And so do you basically ask for, you know, as high amount where it seems reasonable or credible, like, sort of, you know, or not an irrational ask, you know, again, when you're negotiating on behalf of your company?
Okay, so there's a couple parts to your question now. Sorry. So one of them is, should I ask for more than I expect to get? Or that I expect that it might. And the answer is yes, in general. The other one is, I want to be authentic.
Right.
And one of the things that I think is really interesting, because people will talk to me, because I do talk to people a lot about their strategies, and I really say, you know, you really have to stretch, right? I don't think I'm really worth that much, but I want to, you know. And the issue is one of authenticity. I think it's really important for you to be authentic, but I don't think we know until we die what our true authentic self is, because that authentic self should change over time. So maybe what I want to do is I want to check my social network and figure out, what would people like me get for this? And then use that as a way to, as input, not as the sole thing, but as input. Am I asking for way too much? I can't justify it. And then that's just crazy, right? Because you really do have to be in some sort of reasonable range. But what is reasonable for you is probably too low. Okay?
Okay, thanks.
Back here.
So I have I think it's a hard question. Mm-hmm. You are starting to end your slide on who do you advocate for. I run a subsidiary company with a female partner, and together we work for a male boss, and there are several other companies. She has worked at the company for 10 years, and I have worked at the company for 4 years. 2 years ago, I went in for a raise, and I got the raise. And because I tended to work with this girl at the time, he called her up to the office, he granted her a raise, and he gave her a small percentage more than me. And then she was diagnosed with a brain tumor, and she went out. He paid her full salary, and I bore, or how do you say that? Mm-hmm. I did a lot
all
of the
work.
It was a really challenging year, 2 years. She is well, and she has finally come back to work, and she is ready for a raise, as am I. But the question is, she does not ask, and I very much do ask, and do I advocate for her, or do I go in on my own?
Well, there are a couple of things that I would think about. Number one, I would not be, so the fact that she got more or less than you doesn't change how much value you claim in the deal. Because it's not necessarily, I mean, obviously it's not a fixed pie, because as soon as you got a raise, that it didn't change how many pairs of shoes you could buy, right? It's your raise. But you're saying, well, wait, maybe this isn't fair, and now that's a different criteria. So the way I would work that is I would actually go in to my boss, who actually seems to be for whom fairness seems to be an appropriate strategy. He wants to be perceived as fair. And say, okay, I stepped up to the plate, and now the difference now is, it used to be 6 years difference, now there's 4 years difference, but for 2 years you were doing more work than that. So the question of whether, the question is now, how much does this performance that you have merit a raise? And if she gets slightly more than that, it really doesn't change your value.
So here's the other challenge is, recently he said, she said in a meeting amongst the three of us, she said, I feel like the big sister and you're like the little sister. And he said, I don't see it that way. I see you two as twins, which could only be like so annoying for her. And I feel that pain because I recognize it. But at the same time, I can't stop advocating for myself and my growth.
And I think now he's just given you all the ammunition you need for a raise. That's not going to be different than hers. Okay. So I think you should have high expectations, and I think they'll probably be met.
Thank you.
All right, thank you very much, ladies. Appreciate your being here.